Welcome to the Pragmatic Podcast for June 4th, 2008, Studios and Screencasting, the stuff that doesn't fit in books.
You can go so far in the book and you can take people so far, but at some point you just want to say, here, look at this.
That's Mike Clark, creator of the Pragmatic Studios and producer of the Pragmatic Screencasts. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and this week I talk to Mike about his projects that are designed to take the pragmatic experience and extend them beyond the book. He runs the Pragmatic Studio, which is intense training sessions led by two teachers, as well as the Edge Conferences, a single-track experience designed to sharpen the saw. Mike has also been part of three books for the Prags. In fact, his automation book was the first Prag book not written by Dave Randy. He explains that
the Pragmatic Version Control book was out and the unit testing book was out. And I had met Dave actually at a No Fluff. And I said, hey, I like those two books a lot. And he said, cool, do you want to write the third one? And I said, I'd love to write a third book for you, but it has to be the automation book because I was really very keen on automation at the time. So yeah, it was the first non-Dave and Andy book, I guess. And I helped Dave with the Rails book, specifically some of the testing stuff in the initial Agile Web Development with Rails. And then just finished up the Advanced Rails Recipes book, which kind of is, you know, takes off from the Rails book in a recipe format, really spearheaded by Chad Fowler, who started that whole great series of Rails recipes.
In a way, I think there are people that have read your work and might not know it's yours. You did this series of three articles for Apple's developer website on Ruby on the Mac.
Yeah, that was a really fun series to do. They've been keen on Rails for quite a while. We wrote a article on Rails on the Mac, and then it came back around when they started pushing out Leopard. They said, hey, let's do a little bit longer article on Rails and talk a little bit about deployment. I started writing that, and it just kind of snowballed into three different parts because they kept saying, oh, well, let's also show this and this other thing. So it ended up being a three-parter with the third part very much being centered on how to deploy Rails on Leopard, and they've been doing a ton of work in that area just to make that whole process a lot easier for folks that are on Leopard server.
In addition to the writing, you've had this kind of, I guess, it's an odd role with the Prags, is stuff that doesn't seem to be suited for books seems to fall in your lap. You helped code up the website, you started the studios, you've got the Edge.
I love to do all sorts of different things, and I don't like to do necessarily any of them full time. So I love doing development. I'm a programmer. I just enjoy the programming process. It's a nice creative outlet for me, and it's where I really started. So there was an opportunity to rewrite the Pragmatic Store, and I'd been using Rails before that and actually developed another e-commerce site, actually a bookstore in Rails. So when that came along to do the rewrite, Dave and I chatted, and I very much wanted to do the development on that. So I took on the development effort of that, and that was, you know, that became my development project. And then, you know, being a book author, I just really felt like, you know, wow, it would be great to, you know, get some folks together and have a workshop around these books, have something real and live where people can come and ask questions and do some teaching. And I'd been doing private training for years before that. And so we came up with this idea of holding these studios, these small workshops centered around a particular topic on a book, and make it kind of like a project setting. We do a lot of live coding in the studios. We actually build a project over the course of these three-day studios. And instead of just doing them like in one spot, we thought, well, we'll go out and meet people where they're at. It's a really good time. It's a fun time to meet people in the community, really connect with the Pragmatic audience. It's been a ton of fun working with Dave teaching and working with everybody, really.
How do you decide when a topic merits a studio? You've got 3 days worth of stuff for it, and it really lends itself to this learning by doing and you know, building on something.
That's a really great question. I think there are certain topics that lend themselves really well for a show you in person, a community sort of let's get together and talk about this. And you could probably do this with every book topic, for example. But Rails specifically at the time when we started the studio with Rails was something where the book was out there and people were reading it. And to some extent, it was like, okay, I kind of understand, you know, what's going on. But what I really want to do is see the whole process. You know, I want to know the Rails specific things, but I also want to know how do you guys go about building a project with Rails? What is the agile methodology you use? How would you sit down and start coding these? And so we felt that that was a kind of a ripe time for a Rails studio, because a lot of people were coming into the community and trying to learn this. This was the very early days of Rails, but just needing that sort of little extra hand. And there was also a very strong community component to Rails that made it powerful to get everyone together into one room to discuss things and ask questions and just have fun. But we're still kind of working out which topics we do. There's a lot of different ones we could do, and at some point it's just a matter of how many we can put on at once. And also, you know, finding good folks who can teach those, you know, experts in their field who have the time to go out and teach these and, you know, go, you know, across the country and put these on.
So the studios are really focused. I actually haven't been to one of those, but last summer I got to go to your Rails Edge in Chicago, and that's a totally different vibe.
Yeah, the studios are a classroom setting, and it's really like traditional teaching, but in a project-like kind of environment. So you do have labs, and we do, you know, sort of lecture, but there's a ton of live coding as well. But that it's really a training course. The Edge is a small conference. It's 125, 150 people, a multi-speaker setting where we just have them talk about topics that are timely, or stuff that they're working on, or things that they're really keen on. And it's a single track environment, which is really important to us because it means that everyone is together in the same room for the whole time. They hear all the same talks, so the discussions very much focus around that, and we don't sort of fragment things. So yeah, they're really different. The studios are in-depth training, and the Edge is more like continuous education. You know, I want to come back after a year of training and see what new things are going on, and I want to hear from multiple speakers. Although we always teach with two trainers in the room during studio, just to get a back and forth discussion going and to kind of play off of each other. In the Edge, we turn that up a bit, and we have, you know, a dozen speakers or so.
One of the things I think is kind of fun about working with these guys is someone will have an idea and you'll just go with it. And one of the ideas was, well, have a second speaker for a session who is not the domain expert and acts sort of as a proxy for the audience.
In the studio, we've always taught with two people. We tend to kind of joke around saying that the second person, it plays the color commentary, much like a sports announcer would. It's really sort of a rhythm that happens, because generally one person is really focused on conveying a message or teaching, really focused on the core of the course. And they're very much involved. They're pointing at the screen. They may be typing. They may be coding. And the other person, the person playing color commentary, plays an equally important role. And that is, they're watching the people in the room, and they can kind of notice when there are furrowed brows and maybe things are going too fast. And they also sort of chip in. And Dave and I do this a lot back and forth, and he'll be doing something, and I might say, hey, you know, we tried this a couple weeks ago, and we sort of had this problem with this thing. What was that about? Or if you didn't do it that way, what's another way you could do it? Or we just kind of play off of each other. One of us plays the role of the real primary teacher at the time, and one of us plays the role of kind of someone looking in from the outside, but also just sort of keeping things going and keeping things kind of real and casual. And then we trade off, of course. Consistently, people say about a studio that they really like having two distinct perspectives up front, and they like when we disagree. It reinforces that these things aren't always black and white. You know, doing development and doing design, there are always trade-offs to things. And they want to hear those multiple perspectives, because that gives them a way to go back to their project and use those same sort of discussion skills and those debating skills to work with their team. So that's two speakers is a really important component to what we do.
Each medium is good for its own sort of thing. So at a conference, you get that crosstalk, you get the hallway conversation, a book, you have time to reread something you didn't get, you can really look at the code. And now you've introduced screencasts. What are you trying to do with screencasts?
Well, coming back to your point, I think staying true to whatever medium you're focusing on is really important. Each of these different mediums, be it books or screencasts or in-person training, they all have certain strengths to them, And it's easy to kind of fall into the trap of doing screencasts like books or doing training like books. But the reality is that books are really good at some things, and there are difficult things to do in books as well. And training is really good at certain things, and then you don't want to do some things in training. The medium of the studio works because people really want to be around other people in the studio. They want to ask other people questions face to face. They want to ask us questions face to face. They want this sort of time and motion thing that you only get with in-person people. They want to share what they're doing with other people. I mean, it's a super high, you know, intense interaction sort of environment. So they may have read the book at home, sitting, you know, in their favorite chair or something. And while they're doing that, they're learning a bunch, of course. But at the same time, they're having some questions like, well, I wonder what other people do in this scenario. Or I think I understand that, but I'm not quite sure. It'd be really good if I could ask somebody. And that's where the studio really shines, because they not only get to ask us, well, there's two of us there, they get to ask, you know, the other 30 or 40 people that are in the studio as well. And get this feeling like, okay, I'm not alone. You know, there are five other people who do this too. Or it may be the case of, we are a one-off. Maybe we shouldn't be doing it this way because everyone else is going this other direction, and we don't want to get left behind. So that's where the studio medium really shines, is being able to cement some of the concepts that people have learned in the books in a training environment. The screencasts are, to me, a different medium altogether, although they share some of the same aspects of teaching in the books. In the screencast, we don't do any sort of referencing thing. Watching somebody go through a sort of API list or a background of libraries in a screencast is really, really boring. I mean, you just don't want to spend your time doing that. And it's too slow. It's really hard to parse. You can't go back and scan it really easily. It's just not made for reference stuff. But where I think it really shines is people really enjoy when we live code in the studio. So we build an application over 3 days, and we live code parts of it, and then they code parts of it as well. And we kept getting this feedback over the years. Hey, we really like the live coding. Would you guys screencast those? And we said, well, we could probably do that, but I mean, you wouldn't really have the context of the whole class. And they said, no, we would really like that sort of thing screen captured. And we never did it because it really gets in the way of training. If you feel like you're recording the screen while you're going, it just kind of got in the way for things. I think what people like about it is they want to see somebody else do some coding, and they want to see it happen real, meaning they want to see the mistakes and how you get out of them. They want to see all the little tools that you're using on your desktop. They want to see how fast or slow you type. I mean, they want to see that workflow. You're just kind of coding along, and you just do things based on intuition, and you can't necessarily always explain why you did it that way. When you record those live coding sessions, you watch that sort of workflow, I think people pick up all sorts of little things around the edge. The screencasts to us are a way to reach people in that interactive way, let them shoulder surf over experts in the field building applications, and not necessarily have to travel to come to a studio and get that full, you know, in-person feel. So it's sort of a middle ground there.
How have you worked with the people who are producing the screencasts to get them to understand the experience that you're trying to get across?
I just started reaching out to people that we know through writing books. For example, Bill Dudney with Core Animation, just saying, hey, we want to do this screencasting project, and I want to make it like you're building an application and I'm sitting next to you, but it can't be sort of silent. I want you to basically be talking to me as we go. I just reached out to those folks, and we got, you know, four initial people from Expression Engine and the Erlang community, and then Active Record with Rails, Core Animation with Bill Dudney. And we just started working it that way. Screencasting is really difficult to work with and edit, because unlike doing something with a book where somebody sends you a chapter and you say, oh, you know, on page 3, this flows kind of weird, can you sort of rearrange that? You really can't do that when somebody sends you a 15-minute screencast and you say, you know, in minute 2, I don't think you should do it that way. I think you should do it another way. Because going back and editing just that segment is really sort of difficult to do. Because it may impact things before it. And just recording that, you just do multiple takes. So we just started with really small iterations. Our screencasts are 20 to 30 minute episodes in programming, but initially they would send me really small pieces of movies. And we just went through several iterations until we kind of all got the feel of what it felt like. And we shared screencasts, between creators. So we all kind of got that feel initially. And then over time, we started doing longer and longer segments, but we still try to keep them pretty small so that we can fine tune the editing process.
I'm editing Bill's Core Animation book, Core Animation. You want to see the animation. And so it seems to me the screencasts work really well with the book. Neither one replaces the other, but they really work well together.
Yeah, the Core Animation one, it's one of those things that has a strong visual appeal. You can go so far in the book and you can take people so far, but at some point you just want to say, here, look at this. The other part of that one that has a strong visual appeal to me is the Xcode portion. And it's easier for me as somebody learning Xcode to just see how he does it.
Now, what about things that aren't visual? I face this all the time in podcasting. Anytime I've done a successful podcast for a big company, the next thing they said is, next year we'll do video. And you say, well, what does video add to you? And their answer is always, well, video's cooler. We got to do video. And so they produce video that could have been audio. When you produce a screencast, you've got to be aware that it's got to be visual the whole time to engage someone, that you don't have a static image on a screen and minutes go by of them just talking about it.
Yeah, it's funny. When you're live coding in a screencast and somebody pauses for more than 5 or 10 seconds, you really notice it and you're bored. So you do need to keep that going. If they are pausing before they type or after they type something, then the value comes from them saying, I could do this a couple different ways right here, and I'm kind of trying to decide which way, but because this line of code up here is doing this thing, I think I'm going to choose this way. If there are moments where there's not action, they're filling that with opportunities for you to get basically inside their head. Stuff that, again, they're working on intuition, and they kind of have to slow down and say, wait a second, I need to kind of explain why I'm doing this. Not explain too much, because I don't just want to bore people, but just say, I'm going to do it this way because. The strong visual appeal is one aspect of screencasting that works, but the other one is this workflow-centric or process-centric things, where it's not the what we could do, it's the this is how I do it. This is the process I go through to build a website, and that involves refactoring code as I go, that involves changing my mind, that involves sometimes making mistakes and trying to work my way out of them. And sometimes it involves just coding a bunch of stuff outright and it just works the first time.
Whether people are producing screencasts for you or they're just playing with it at home, any tips on producing your own screencasts?
One, it's just lots of practice. And don't practice on a 10-minute segment. You practice on a 1-minute segment. I don't feel like I'm really super good at it by any stretch, but I feel like I get better every time I'm in front of the microphone and every time I open up the recording tool and I just try to explain something. Maybe it's the project that I'm actually working on today or it's a new tool that I found. I just sort of practice how I would go about teaching that to somebody and then I just throw it away. But it gives me the experience to do that. The other one is being true to the medium, as we talked about. Doing things in screencasts that screencasts are really good at. If you want to do a podcast where it's audio, make the audio great and entertaining and stuff that people can really want to listen to because there's not that visual component. There has to be something else that ties them in. So staying true to the medium would be the other one. And then finally, it is knowing your audience, because especially with screencasting, when people sit down for 20 minutes to watch a screencast, that takes their whole attention. And so you really have their attention during that 20 minutes. And the question then is, now what? You got to give them enough value to sit there for 20 minutes and not get distracted by everything else that's going on in their computer. I mean, that's really precious time. When you get somebody open up that movie and begin to watch it, I think you have to be really careful about what you do and the value you provide to them.
Yeah, you hear about this with really good conference presenters, how many hours they put into their 45-minute talk. Even if you're delivering a screencast live, there's a lot of prep time that goes into that to get everything right where it needs to be.
Yeah, when you're watching the screencast, it's easy to underappreciate how much time went into the creator coming up with the flow that they're going to go through so that they end up basically at the right place, especially in an episode feel, because you're basically continuing a story episode to episode. And what we've tried to do is keep that true to its form in terms of a project. And the easiest way to do that is just to ask the creator, what would you do in this situation? And sometimes they'll say, well, I would do this, but people aren't really going to be interested. And I always say, record it. Because the things that you think aren't necessarily that interesting are the stuff that people really can't get anywhere else. Because you don't think it's interesting, you haven't written it down in book form, or you may not have told somebody. But those are the things where when you're watching over somebody's shoulder, you go, oh, that's really cool. How did you do that? And they say, oh, well, it's just this thing over here. You know, it's that intuition at work as well. So planning things out, you know, we do scripting and we do outlining beforehand, because once you turn on the recorder, you got to know where you're going with things. Now, we like to have, you know, little ad hoc impromptu things happen as well, but you have to have a general overall flow, much like you have to do in a book. So there is a ton of prep time involved, and the recording time just pales in comparison, really.
That's Mike Clark on the Pragmatic Podcast talking about the new screencast that he launched last week, as well as the Pragmatic Studios. As always, you can find more information about our books, screencasts, and training at pragprog.com. Our podcasts are at pragprog.com/podcasts, and you can join the discussion at forums.pragprog.com. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Andy Hunt. For the Pragmatic Programmers, I'm Daniel Steinberg.